From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The chief judge of the Court of Appeals, Maryland's highest court, was named to the job a year ago this month. Chief Judge Mary Ellen Barbera is here to discuss her first year as administrative head of the state's judicial system and how she wants to shape it. Then, coastal flooding is increasing along the eastern seaboard. A new analysis by the Reuters news agency pointed to Annapolis as the most vulnerable city. How much water in Annapolis makes a flood, and how does the city prepare? We asked the Annapolis Office of Emergency Management. Plus, what should you be reading this summer? Carla Hayden, head of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, brings us her picks.
This is the best time, whether you're on the beach or a balcony or backyard. You get the time, and that's what summer gives you to read.
First news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Mary Ellen Barbera was a public school teacher in Baltimore when she began taking night law school classes at the University of Maryland. About 30 years ago, she graduated from law school, passed the Maryland bar, and started down a path that would lead her to Maryland's highest court, the Court of Appeals. A year ago this month, she became that court's first female chief judge. And she joins me now in the studio to talk about her first year in that role. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
Before we get into this year, I want to go back a few years. As I mentioned, you were a teacher before you were a lawyer. What motivated you to switch from the classroom to the courtroom?
Well, I had, you may or may not know, I was a school teacher in Baltimore City for 8 years. And my brother-in-law was a lawyer, and I had been teaching for several years. And I thought that I might very much want to do something a little bit different. I was always very interested in education and education for myself. So I considered law school, thought about it for a bit, and then decided that I would take a shot. And so I took
So is this
LSAT.
One of those things you started night classes not knowing if this was really what you wanted to do?
Not completely sure, but I have never regretted that decision. Every opportunity I've had as a lawyer has been a wonderful one, a growing experience, a learning experience, and it's just been fabulous. So no regrets. However, I am still interested in education, and I teach law school. You may or may not.
Yeah, I saw on your bio that you are teach at American University.
I do. Before that,
criminal procedure.
Yes.
When you were named chief judge, the headlines were first female named chief judge of Maryland's Court of Appeals. What is the significance to you of being the first female chief judge?
Well, it was such an honor to be named by Governor O'Malley, not just as chief judge and by that appointment being the head of the Maryland judiciary, but being the first woman. And certainly I've had my role models, professional and personal, some of whom have been women. I teach many women law students. I enjoy working with young men and women as interns and as law clerks. And I feel very keenly that this is an opportunity not just to do my job and handle all the administration of the judiciary, as well as be chief judge of the Court of Appeals, but also to demonstrate that all things are possible for not just men, but women. And so I take very seriously that my colleagues and young women who are thinking about law school look to me as at least an example of what can be attained, what is possible for every one of us.
So you are a year into this job, 1 year in. I understand you've traveled across the state visiting circuit courts and district courts. What did you learn?
I learned so very much. I am very much a visual person. So I wanted to visit the courthouses, not just to see the courthouses, but of course to talk to my judicial colleagues. And as, if not even more important, to have an opportunity to meet and talk with and to thank, really, not just on behalf of the judges, but really all the people of Maryland, the many women and men, and there are 4,000 of us in the state judiciary, many of us in the field, in the courthouses. They are the people who support not just what the judges do, but they are often the front line. They deal directly not just with lawyers, but with other individuals who, for one reason or another, are accessing the courts. So I learned so much about what they do, and it helped me understand and recognize what we were doing well, what else I could do to improve the delivery of judicial services, access to the courts. It has been a wonderful experience, and I will take what I've learned, and not just but from looking, but from listening, and see what we can do, what policies and practices and improvements we can make to further what, for me, is the lodestar, meaningful access to the courts. So
what needs to be done? What's your first priority about meaningful access? You're talking about for...
I'm talking...
Access for whom?
Access for everyone who, for whatever combination of reasons, feels the need to get some form of redress through the judicial process.
Do you see blockages in access?
I see challenges. We are a wonderfully diverse state, and that includes folks who, for some, confront a language barrier. So we want to be sure that we can facilitate their access to courts in such a way that those barriers are eliminated, or at least to the extent possible, mitigated. That's one challenge we have, and it's a challenge going forward. Another challenge that we have, and I've noticed, not just from my visits, but from what I've learned otherwise, is we have an increasing number of self-represented litigants. And my goal, and it should be the goal for all of us, the bench and the bar, is to have a lawyer for every self-represented litigant who wants legal services but cannot afford them. So I've witnessed that as I've traveled around the courts and, of course, learned of those challenges that are confronting my judicial colleagues as they're working with self-represented litigants and those for whom, as I said, language might be a barrier. Those are just two examples of what I've learned and hope to work on. And it's important that I put a lot of energy to dealing with both of those challenges.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Chief Judge Mary Ellen Barbera of the Maryland Court of Appeals, the state's highest court. We're talking about her first year heading Maryland's judicial system. I understand one of the questions you've been thinking about is how to improve the juvenile justice system. And as you know, we saw it in the debate earlier this year over the Baltimore Juvenile Justice Center. There's an ongoing debate about institutionalizing young offenders versus treating them in the community. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I will mention at the outset that I did visit the Juvenile Justice Center and was happy to have the opportunity to see all that is being done, not just the courts themselves and the judges who are there, but also the related services that are being provided there. The challenges remain many for the juvenile justice generally, whether it is young people, children really, who confront the system as children in need of assistance, or those who have come into contact with the system through the through delinquency, having been charged with a delinquent act, or even more concerning still, those who are still teenagers, but because of the system of our laws, can sometimes, for very serious crimes, be charged as adults. We have families in crisis. So there's a whole host of issues related to our young people. I care very deeply as a former educator, as one who continues to educate, but really all of us should be concerned about our young people. So I'm looking at a number of ways in which we might be able to achieve better outcomes. One of the initiatives that I'm very excited about is that I will be hosting a Mid-Atlantic Region's Juvenile Justice Summit. We hope to have that happen in Annapolis either in the spring or the fall of 2015, hopefully in Annapolis. And it will bring not just the judges and others from our sister states nearby, but also experts from around the country. We are looking at best practices. We're looking at what might work for Maryland. Again, this collaborative effort to identify not just where the problems are, but how we can get to those to the solutions to those problems. It's not an easy fix, but we will be working on it, and I will certainly be devoting a lot of my energy to that.
A promise you have made is that the court will issue decisions on all cases heard during this term before this term ends. The last day is August 31st. You're on track for that?
We certainly are. We're right on target.
How have you adjusted the caseload in order to do that?
Well, we have reduced slightly the number of cases that we hear on any given day. The Court of Appeals sits, it's similar but not identical to the United States Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals, our state Supreme Court, sits 4 days every month from September through June. And we have a series of cases that we hear each of those 4 days. We have reduced slightly as we are moving to this system of, if we've heard the case in the term, we decided in the term, or certainly before the beginning of the next term. So we have modified that to just, we're not taking fewer cases, we're just modifying our docketing so that we can move the cases through both efficiently and timeliness is crucial. That's part of meaningful access to justice, really, and to the courts. Efficiently, yet with devotion, requisite devotion to the quality of the product. After all, what the Court of Appeals does, and what its mission is, what its responsibility is announcing for bench and bar generally what the law is. So we must devote the energy that's necessary for good decision making, and that's part of it. But also, certainty in when the decision will be made is good for all concerned, not just the lawyers, not just the parties they represent, but bench and bar generally, and all interested stakeholders in the outcome, and the people of Maryland, quite frankly. It instills and fosters, I believe, trust and confidence in the judiciary.
We have less than a minute,
yes.
And so I'm going to just quickly jump to, I was surprised to learn that briefs are not filed electronically, that the Maryland judicial system is not yet in the electronic age. I understand there's going to be a pilot project in Anne Arundel County starting in the fall?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Maryland Electronic Courts. We are beginning in the fall in Anne Arundel County. Yes, indeed.
When is it going to be statewide?
It's going to be a multi-year approach because we want to proceed cautiously, carefully, to make sure that we identify all of our issues early on. That's why we have a six-month pilot program in Anne Arundel County. I'm very excited. We are the first state in the country to do this at all courts at the same time.
And we are flat out of time. I really do appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
It has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you, Sheila.
Chief Judge Mary Ellen Barbera of the Maryland Court of Appeals, the state's highest court. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And just ahead, how is Annapolis responding to the rising tide? Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Reuters news agency published its analysis last week of coastal flooding along the eastern seaboard. They tracked the average number of days several East Coast cities were above flood thresholds. At 34 days, the number one vulnerable coastal city is Annapolis. We want to know how the city of Annapolis prepares for floods, recovers from floods, and if Annapolis is experiencing an increase in coastal floods like so many other East Coast cities. Joining me now is Dave Mandel, Public Information Officer for the Annapolis Office of Emergency Management. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
To start, we asked Dr. Don Bosch, Professor of Marine Science and President of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, what conditions lead to flooding in the city dock area of Annapolis. Here's part of what he said.
The average sea level has been rising over the decades, ever so much. And, of course, when you see a flooding event like this, it means that the weather conditions are causing the water levels to be higher than average. And that's usually a result of wind. Usually winds blowing up the bay from the south that push water up the bay. And so we have higher tidal water levels. The other thing, of course, which can influence that is a major hurricane. We had a hurricane coming up the coast that could drive water into the bay, raise the tidal level. So those are the things, the wind events and tropical storms that affect these extreme water levels.
So, Dave, you've been working with the city's Office of Emergency Management for 4 years, right? Have you noticed an increase in flooding?
You know, flooding is something we deal with every day. It's something we think about every day because it's probably the one event that has the greatest impact day in, day out in terms of being in Annapolis. It seems that it's become very prominent in the last few years. If you talk to some of the old timers in Annapolis, they tend to tell you, you know, informally, they'll say, well, you know, we've always worried about flooding, but now it just seems like it comes more frequently than it used to.
And we've had some downpours recently, but heavy rain is not really the issue in flooding in Annapolis, right?
Absolutely, and that's a really good point to distinguish, is that a lot of people think heavy rain and think, well, okay, now I have to worry about flooding. In Annapolis, it's a little bit different because there's other kind of flooding from the tides. So you can have a cloudless day and a nice blue sky day, you know, just very much like we're seeing this week. And if the wind is just right and the tides come in at a certain time, you could have flooding downtown.
And how does the city monitor impending floods? What tools?
Well, you know, there are some great, actually, public sites that are available. The National Weather Service, they use something called the Advanced Hydrologic Prediction Service. So they've got a sensor, a gauge, right at the Naval Academy, and they publish the information online. You can Google it right now and find it. And it'll have the current water level. So several times a day, we're always checking the water level over there at that sensor, and we're constantly keeping track of any watches, warnings, or advisories that the National Weather Service is issuing for Annapolis.
And so at what point do you get concerned and spring into action? And when you spring into action, what do you do?
Great question. We start really getting concerned if the water gets about 3 feet or so, or 3.2 feet above what they call the mean lower low water level. Basically, I can explain what that means. There are two high tides every day, and there are two low tides every day. So the mean lower low tide, the lowest of the low tides. Once we get about 3 to 3.2 feet above the mean lower low water level, that's when the city dock, the parking lot right there, starts to flood, and 3.3 feet or so, the water starts to lap up a little bit against the some of the lower-lying businesses in that area. Also, we have Compromise Street is the main street we have that runs right along the water next to the harbor. And that will start to flood around 3.3, 3.4 feet. So at that point, we may have to close that road and reroute some traffic.
What are some of the other steps that the city takes when waters are starting to rise?
Well, there are a lot of different levels of actions that we can take. If we're talking about the nuisance flooding, if it's 3.3 or 3.5 feet, we'll place barricades around the area so cars can't get through and get trapped. And that'll be the city dock, and that'll be Compromise Street, like I mentioned.
A lot of flooding, you sort of take in stride.
That's right. Sometimes there are different kinds of flooding, and the nuisance flooding is the kind of flooding we're talking about. We're just at the level to make a disruption in the area, you know, close streets or maybe, park further away, and that's not uncommon. That's different than what we think of as, you know, water rushing across the street and people having to get rescued in boats. That's another level entirely. And obviously we're concerned about that too, but.
And that's, in terms of numbers, you said the nuisance flooding, even three and a half feet is nuisance.
I can see.
What are the numbers when you're rescuing people out of rowboats?
Well, if we think of, here's one way I like to put it into context. So we're talking about three and a half feet. Tropical storm Isabel back in 2003 was about 7.5 feet.
Double that.
It was double that. And that flooded the Market House, and that flooded a good portion of the lower level of downtown. So that's catastrophic. So I'd also like to mention as well that I'm talking about the specific instances that we engage into, the specific actions we take once it starts to flood. But flooding is something that we take into account in all the planning that we do because it's so prominent. We have an evacuation plan, for example, should that become necessary. We did evacuation workshops in May for city employees to show them how that works. We've got 7 evacuation routes and pickup points, and we could do a whole other segment on that. We've done hurricane workshops. In June, we did that as well. So the flooding really comprises quite a bit of the larger planning efforts that we engage in.
And what is the city doing by way of looking at ways to guard against flooding?
So one thing we've been experimenting with, actually, is backflow preventers downtown. So the idea is when this flooding comes up through it actually comes up through the storm drains. The tidal flooding comes up through the storm drains as opposed to the heavy rain, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So if we can place a valve that opens for the rain but closes on the other side to the floodwaters, that could really prevent a lot of disruptions. Also, even having a mitigation plan, it allows us to be eligible for federal mitigation funding. So after many disasters, I should say, certain federal mitigation funding becomes available only to communities that have certain mitigation plans approved. And Annapolis is one of those communities. So if, you know, an impact does occur in spite of the mitigation plan, having that plan in effect will allow us to get some assistance from the federal government.
I appreciate you talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dave Mandel is the Public Information Officer for the Annapolis Office of Emergency Management. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, including info on how to get the Prepare Me Annapolis app for smartphones. We also have more of our conversation about how coastal flooding is playing out in Maryland with Dr. Don Bosch of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Special thanks to our intern, Justina Latimer, for her production help with this interview. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, Dr. Carla Hayden on Hot Summer Reads. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us this morning. I'm Tom Hall. Artscape starts today. It's billed as the largest free arts festival in the United States, and there will be, as always, a full palette of music, dance, theater, film, visual arts, along with plenty of food and the chance to join 350,000 or so of your closest friends to enjoy a really great time. And when Mount Royal Avenue finally gets back to normal next week, you may want to recover from all that art and excitement by curling up with a good book. And for some suggestions about what we might want to read, we turn to someone who always has some great ideas. Dr. Carla Hayden is the director of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, and she joins me in the studio. Good morning and happy summer.
This is a wonderful time to read. You could see by the bag of books that I
brought
in.
You come in with,
it's just
as always,
loaded, and it's also a commercial for ebooks because of the weight, but this is the best time whether you're on the beach or a balcony or backyard. you get the time, and that's what summer gives you to read. And so we have so many things.
Got lots of stuff. You got some fiction and some
really
nonfiction. We're going to start with one by Emma Straub called The Vacationers.
And it's just about vacationing and what can happen when you get your family together 2 weeks in Mallorca, that island that's so beautiful, and you take your time off from your busy life in Manhattan. So this is about a family that does that, and they have their teenage daughter, and they are having their 35th anniversary, and wouldn't this be wonderful with this wonderful island? Well, you can imagine what
stuff
might
happens.
Happen. Uh-huh. And over the course of the vacation, secrets come to light, old and new humiliations, childhood rivalries, all of these things happen. And it ends up, though, people going home and just thinking about what vacation really means. So if you need
a nice
light
like a two-week version of Thanksgiving.
Right, it is. So it's a perfect one to
right,
start.
So what would better now, thing to be on vacation and read a
and
book
then read about
called
vacation.
The Vacationers
now,
by Emma Straub.
The next one, though, many people probably read the book The Dinner, a psychological thriller.
Right.
So he has a new book out now.
This is Herman Koch, Summer House with Swimming Pool.
Well, we're getting a little darker now.
Yeah.
So this is a summer house that's a beautiful house on the Mediterranean. And there's a plastic surgeon and one of his famous clients is there. And they're all there together. And something happens. And it gets darker and darker. And so even though the setting is wonderful, this summer house with the swimming pool becomes quite the cauldron mm-hmm. of jealousies and different things. And one of the protagonists dies, and it becomes really not so wonderful, but definitely will keep you going if you're on the beach. You're going to look at your neighbors a little differently.
Right. All right.
So he's got another one that's really great.
Herman Koch. And I think I'm pronouncing his name right. It's spelled K-O-C-H.
Right.
I've heard it Koch.
And if you read The Dinner, you're
going
to love
he's a,
this
he is
one.
A good
Summer
teller
House
of tales.
Swimming pool.
All right. So Summer House with Swimming Pool, Herman Koch. And now we have one by Lisa Moore called Caught.
Yes. Now, this one takes you to the 70s. And you have a young man who escapes from prison. He has some marijuana problems. And he's determined to have one big heist left with the drug running and to win his girlfriend back. And it takes him all over the United States, and it just keeps you going, and you're wondering, and you're rooting for him. He's like Billy the Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of want this guy, who's not the brightest bulb,
yeah.
to make it and to make something of his life. So
this
could
be
his
swan song heist.
This is his swan song, but it gives you along, and you're just rolling along with him. And so it's a fun one.
That's Caught by Lisa Moore. And, of course, we'll have all of these listed on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, here's one, which is a great postcard epitaph. I'm having so much fun here without you.
Yes.
By Courtney Maugham.
Oh, this one I love because it's a love story set in Paris and London. And what happens when a gentleman who is an artist and he has some fidelity problems and he leaves his wife and then he has an epiphany and he wants to get her back. And she's having a great time without him in Paris and London.
She has moved on, as
they say. She has moved on. And so what happens? He's having this midlife crisis. He's trying to woo her back and paint another painting that's going to bring her back and all of this stuff. And it just really gets you in the mood of being in Paris and having someone trying to... And get you.
And I know that you're a big fan of Paris yourself.
Big fan of Paris. So this is the perfect place and a kind of fun book.
All right. So I'm having so much fun here without you. That's by Courtney Maugham on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Dr. Carla Hayden, the director of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. And we are talking about some summer reads here for some midsummer fun. The next one we have is a book by Megan Abbott. It's called The Fever.
Now, this one, really, the cover just grabs you. You have a young woman, and she's obviously in distress. And what happens is that there's a family that's very close-knit, and the teenage daughter is stricken with a mysterious fever. And then the young ladies in the rest of the community start catching the fever. And there's some discussion and really concern of what is this? No one can tell what this fever is, and so it draws you in. And you might see some relationship to something that's been in the news about the last year or so, when a community of young women had the same type of physical affliction. So this takes you into that to see what happens with this fever.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I remember a novel by Walker Percy, and the name of the novel is escaping me, but everybody gets afflicted by this sort
right.
of, and it makes them start behaving in strange ways.
And this one,
so that's an interesting premise for a book.
Very much, and of course there's secrets and friendships and all types of things in a small town, so that really gets you going.
All right, The Fever, that's by Megan Abbott. And then we've got one here by Christina Enriquez. It's called The Book of Unknown Americans.
Now, this book is being listed on every list of best books for the summer. And it's very timely because it deals with immigrants who are coming from Mexico and Panama and trying to find a life in the United States. And so it draws you into these two families and, of course,
but
the
it's
teenagers.
Fiction, of course. We're
fiction,
about a novel.
But it definitely gives you the perspective of people who are coming to the United States for a better life. And it's two families whose teenagers fall in love, one from Panama, of course, and one from Mexico, and what happens. So you're hearing the perspective of the parents, the teenagers, all of these people who are really trying to make that life here. And so right now what's going on, it's really timely.
And that's one of the great things about fiction, that you can get an insight and a perspective into issues that, you know, otherwise we'd really have no sense about. I mean, you know, so many of us are so far removed from the immigrant situation. Obviously, it's in the news, these poor children, you know, just going through these horrendous journeys. You can only imagine what they're leaving. And then when they get here, it's a very complex geopolitical problem, but to really understand it rather than read just news reports. I mean, I think
right.
it'd be really great to read some fiction
right.
to
and
get
this
inside
so,
characters. You know?
Right, and you're talking about a 15-year-old who has an injury and needs medical care that you can only get in the United States. So all of these other things that might contribute to people wanting to come to the United States. So
right,
this
so
one is really highly recommended.
Right, the Book of Unknown Americans, Christina Enriquez. The next one we have is a book called All the Light We Cannot See. That's by Anthony Doerr.
Also critically acclaimed, and well, this is a book that will start getting you into those rainy days in summer when you have, you know, you can't go to the beach, you can't go outside, but you have an opportunity and time to just settle down. And this book takes you into World War II and also starts in Paris with a blind young girl who's 6 years old, and her father works at a museum. And he creates a model of their neighborhood so she can learn how to negotiate the neighborhood. And he'll take her out on the street and say, okay, find your way home.
Remember your model.
Remember
yeah. Oh,
that.
Isn't that fascinating?
And
what a great premise.
Of course, she meets later on in life a young German boy who is very good with fixing radios and gets incorporated into the Hitler Youth program because of his technological skills. And so they end up meeting, and that really is quite a love story and quite a story about what happens when people try to do the best thing they can for other people in very difficult circumstances.
Wonderful.
So
right,
this one is just moving and just beautiful book.
All right, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. And we also have some nonfiction here. Here's a nonfiction book about a very famous fiction writer, Ann Perry. It's called The Search for Ann Perry, The Hidden Life of a Best-Selling Crime Writer. This is by Joanne Drayton.
Well, this one was actually somewhat disturbing but very, very interesting. You really can't put it down. In 1994, the director Peter Jackson released a movie called Heavenly Creatures, and it was based on a famous matricide committed in New Zealand in the 1950s. Two teenage girls, obsessive relationship, and they kill the mother of one of the girls. And the movie actually starred Kate Winslet. This was one of her first movies
uh-huh.
and got her famous. Well, it changed the life of the writer, Ann Perry, who writes historical mysteries, because it was revealed that she was one of the girls.
Wow.
And that had never been revealed before.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book weaves her story as being the best-selling mystery writer that she still is, and the discovery of her role in this
implicated in
infamous murder.
Yeah.
And how the murder happened as well.
Hmm.
So it's really, like I said, it's a little disturbing because if you are interested in what makes a good writer, you also find out that there's so many secrets and so many things that contribute to someone being a good writer. And when do you forgive and forget?
And she was charged with this crime?
Oh, and went to prison.
Yeah.
So it's just a fascinating book, and it really grips you, and you can't put it down. So it makes you wonder about what compels
what's behind
people
the door. Yeah.
To write and to create, and how
search,
to create.
The Search for Ann Perry, The Hidden Life of a Best-Selling Crime Writer, Joanne Drayton. And before we run out of time, Carla Hayden, I want to talk about John Waters' new book.
I have it on my bedside tables.
I haven't read it yet, but John's away for the summer. When he comes back in September, we're going to talk about it. It's called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. And it's gotten great reviews, and
it
sounds like a hoot.
It's so much fun because he hitchhikes from Baltimore to San Francisco, and he's standing outside with a cardboard sign that says, "I'm not psycho." So that people will pick him up, and people pick him up, and he just has the best adventures, and he's, as you can imagine, a great storyteller. So I think if you get people to read it before you hear him, it's really going to be
wonderful. And I guess he divides it into three parts. One is the sort of a fantasy about what might happen, who might pick him up. The other is about who actually does happen. And then there's a third section.
Well, so you can imagine his fantasies are quite vivid.
Yeah, with him. Carsick by John Waters. John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Well, Carla Hayden, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much. As always, appreciate these great suggestions, and have a great rest of the summer.
Happy reading.
Mm-hmm. Carla Hayden is the director of the Enoch Pratt Library, and there are two great exhibitions at the Central Library this summer. I want to tell you about. One's called Making a Difference, African-American Women and the Civil Rights Movement. The other is called Maryland in Black and White, Documentary Photographs from the Great Depression and World War II. They're both being exhibited now at the Central Library. Of course, there's plenty of stuff going on at the Pratt Library and all of the branches. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll have a link to more information and the list of books that Dr. Hayden and I talked about this morning. That's it for us today. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great time at Artscape this weekend. We'll see you Monday.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore.
The program is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. I'm Tom Hall. I'm the culture editor.
Coffee provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville, on the web at zekescoffee.com.
You can find us online at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. You can leave a comment about something you've heard or make a suggestion about an interview you think you should hear on our show.
On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. For the whole Maryland Morning team, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.